Hello, everyone, and welcome to the With Chinese Characters podcast.
Chinese characters.
Sorry. Let's just keep going, Jerry. I'm Natalie. Who are you?
I'm Cherry.
Introduce yourself to the audience. We talk about topics with Chinese characteristics. And today,
good
Cherry.
Good job with the second time.
Thank you. We're talking once again about the Opium War.
Yay! The Arrow War.
Also known as the Second Opium War.
Yeah.
The First Opium War, if you're French. And, yeah, so I want to give a little summary.
Okay.
About what started, you know, in case it's been a month since you listened to the last one.
Yeah.
So the First Opium War ended, or the Opium War ended, and there's a couple of things that the United Kingdom wanted, right? They wanted to make more money.
Yeah.
They wanted to normalize diplomatic relations.
Yeah.
And they wanted some respect. They wanted some
respect. The latest one being the most important one.
They wanted some respect.
Yeah.
You know, especially because they feel like they obviously felt they were superior to the Chinese.
Mm-hmm.
But they wanted to at least be considered as equals.
Mm.
And they basically got none of those things.
Yeah.
They thought they were going to get those things with the treaty they signed, but they realized it didn't actually do any of the things that they wanted.
Yeah.
So they're like, how do we get a better treaty?
Mm.
Well, you got to have another incident.
How do we go beyond the barbarian status?
Yeah, how do we go beyond the barbarian status? And there was a very concerted effort for, okay, as soon as something happens, we're going to use it to press for better terms.
Yeah.
Because China's having a civil war,
mm-hmm.
all these things. Now's the time.
Yeah.
We'll get what they want. The Arrow happened, which we talked about in the last episode, and they used that as an excuse. But however, the governor, Ye Mingchen, in mm-hmm. Canton, was much more uncompromising than they had thought.
Yeah.
And basically shut down the port, blockaded it, and you know, there was basically a low-scale war in Canton.
Yeah.
So
a low-scale war?
Yeah. A small-scale war in Canton. And yeah. So once again the traders there had to go call back to the UK for help.
Yeah.
And say, you know, we're being oppressed because of this incident that we created.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
In 1857,
mm-hmm.
Lord Elgin set off from England with a force of roughly 2,000.
Okay.
His goal was twofold, and he was going to pick up more troops on the way.
Okay, because I was going to say, 2,000, quite a small.
Well, but they thought it's just Canton. We'll just go there, intimidate him a little bit.
Do you know how big Canton is?
It's over a million people.
I know England is a small country.
Well, it's over a million people at this point, Cherry.
Yeah,
but,
okay.
You know, they exactly. thought, we're British, they're not.
Yeah.
It'll be fine.
One of us is 100 of them.
Also, the French are going to show up too. So
okay.
They thought, you know.
They've got allies.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So his two goals were to put an end to the conflict in Canton.
Mm-hmm.
And then, with hostility settled, to gain a new treaty.
Mm.
So this treaty would contain all of the measures the British had been lusting after since the late 18th century, such as permanent residency, free travel, lower tariffs, and diplomatic presence in the capital of Beijing.
Okay.
This is all stuff they wanted all the way back on the Macartney expedition in the 1790s.
Yeah. Can I do a disclaimer here?
Uh-huh.
I said England is a small country.
Yeah.
I meant Great Britain is a small country.
Yeah.
Well, I don't want to reduce the whole country to just...
But the British Empire is not a small country. Because already at this point, they've got India, they got Canada, Australia.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, half the Caribbean,
yeah.
parts of Africa.
Yeah. So we're just counting their atrocities right
yeah.
now. Yeah.
Yeah. Actually, I don't think they have that much of Africa yet, but I think they got some pieces.
Okay.
So,
yeah. So continue, please.
So his plans were derailed somewhat by the Indian Rebellion of 1857, also known as the Indian Mutiny, also known as the First Indian, I think, War of Independence.
Yeah.
You know, different people have different names for it.
Yeah. Let's not say mutiny.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's
to them it was, but.
Well, the reason it's called the mutiny is because large portions of the East India Company, which had its own military,
mm-hmm.
which were primarily Indian troops,
yeah,
they mutinied en masse, and they, you know, stopped following orders, and they attacked, you know, the East India Company government there.
Mm-hmm.
And interestingly enough, it's over something which seems small today, but they were issued a new type. There's a bunch of stuff, but the primary thing was they were issued a new type of gun.
Okay,
and this was instead of the old type of gun where you put the ammunition and the bullet and the thing and you ram it down.
Yeah.
You push it in. This is you load it from the back.
Okay. And what's the problem with that?
The problem is you put the little cartridges in there and they have grease on them to make it go in the back properly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And both the Muslim soldiers and the Hindu soldiers both thought that the grease was either pork or cow or beef grease.
Okay. And were they?
It's not really clear.
Okay.
And there's this whole thing where they're like, okay, we'll give them to you without grease, and then you can put whatever you want in them. And they're like, well, the paper seems waxy. So, like, you know, we don't believe you. So, anyway, it was a whole big thing.
Okay. But,
you know, they almost lost India.
Yeah.
Right? They almost lost the entire colony.
No, that's not a small thing. Well, you gotta be respectful of the religions, you know?
I know, but it's still not really clear. I'm not actually sure if it actually did have the stuff or not.
Right.
And I kind of actually think the people in the East India Company might not have known either. Because, you know, I think they're getting it from England. But anyway.
There's no transparency of supply chains back then.
So, though not all troops rebelled, those that did vastly outnumbered the British colonial troops on hand.
Mm-hmm.
At the request of local officials, Elgin surrendered his small army and the rest of the troops that were supposed to meet him and sent them to India instead.
So he lost his invading
troops.
China army.
Yeah.
Yeah.
These forces, incidentally, were of great help to the British and may have even drastically changed the outcome of the war.
Oh.
So the fact that Elgin was heading there with this force to deal with China and happened to have these troops on hand might have kept India in British hands for another 100 years, which is one of those small things.
Yeah.
So, but now Elgin's on his own. He doesn't have an army.
Yeah.
He's just a guy now.
Okay.
So he went to Calcutta. In Singapore and other places and Hong Kong.
To gather troops?
No, to just kind of, I don't know, he's got to do something.
To have a vacation? Or?
Yeah, just kind of tore around a little bit.
Okay.
And kind of take stock of the situation. Because he's still got a mission. He just doesn't have
troops. Yeah.
So it was during this time, though. So Elgin's an interesting character. He's closer. So we have Harry Parkes, who's the guy, and Palmerston, who's the prime minister.
Mm.
Harry Parkes but he's the one who turned the Arrow incident into this big thing. Mm. He's the one who marched in there and got in a fight with the guards and all this. So he's very cutthroat. Elgin's a little bit more of a softy in that his heart's not entirely in this whole imperialism thing.
Okay.
Partially because he's rich and comes from a very wealthy family.
Yeah.
Whereas somebody like Harry Parkes grew up like in the streets of the Canton factories and you know, he's got to make it there, right?
Yeah.
So Elgin has the luxury of, you know, being a fair weather imperialist. So he became
sort of the privilege of.
The privilege of.
Yeah, champagne socialist.
Champagne socialist. He started to become uncomfortable at the scenes of casual cruelty and privilege the British, including himself, enjoyed over others in the region.
Mm.
This is from Ottoman.
Which was news to him?
News to him.
He didn't know before.
I think it was his first time away.
Being confronted by the reality that has been long existed before his arrival.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The thing that's paying for all of his tea and
his lifestyle. His
lifestyle in the UK. So this is from Autumn in the Heavenly Kingdom by Stephen R. Platt.
Okay. Talking to the microphone.
Oh, sorry. It is a terrible business, this living among inferior races. Terrible, he meant, not because of the treatment of the natives per se, but because of the ostensibly civilized British degraded themselves when they assumed the position of racial superiors.
Oh my God.
Under such circumstances, he believed, all notions of Christian benevolence were forgotten, and with British men and women alike, all that remained in their minds was detestation, contempt, ferocity, vengeance, whether Chinamen or Indians be the object. So he's like, it's not that we're doing bad things to any people. It's that doing bad things to these people is damaging our souls, right? And it's, you know, making us.
Yeah.
So, however, after a few more weeks, this guilty conscience seemed to fade. It soon wears off, he said, and one moves among them with perfect indifference, treating them not as dogs, because in that case one would whistle to them and pat them, but as machines with which one can have no communion or sympathy. So he's basically saying, like, after a while, they're just like, you know, a Roomba.
Yeah.
Or like, I don't know.
Roomba.
You know, like bugs or something.
Yeah. And it was perfectly fine that he wrote that in his Christian values.
I mean, for the time, I mean, that's a fairly progressive view.
I know.
Of saying, you know, sure, we might be better than them, but we shouldn't be doing this to them because, you know, it's not good for us.
Yeah. Let's just say I'm glad that times has moved forward, and we have, as a human race, maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But still, he would continue to be plagued by doubts about this. He would write often to his wife or in his journal, like,
This is not questioned. Okay.
In any case, though, Elgin was in the area, but without his troops. French troops were on their way, but were also some time out. So this is from the narrative of the expedition written by his secretary, Lawrence Oliphant.
Okay.
Who says, "It was clear that any attempt to negotiate in the immediate neighborhood of the capital of the empire, unaccompanied by any force, must depend very much for success upon the moral effect created by the aspect of affairs to the south."
Hmm.
AKA, even if we go up to Beijing, they're not going to listen to us unless we...
Have something to show for it.
The presence of an army at Hong Kong might have sufficed to produce this. But not only was our force there contemptible, but our naval operations had resulted in failure. Ye had vindicated the policy of his treatment of the barbarians, and triumphal arches had been erected to commemorate his success.
Hmm.
I don't know if that's actually true, but basically saying, you know, if we go to Beijing now, they're just going to laugh at us because we can't even push around this provincial governor.
Yeah. So, like, let's show our force.
He's like, you can't do gunboat diplomacy if you send all your gunboats to India, Cherry.
Can't argue with that logic. So what's his proposed solution? Is there one?
No. So he just left.
So he's just like, this is not going
to
work.
He took whatever troops were already there,
uh-huh.
and he went back to India again.
Okay.
And he's like, you know what? I'll come back later.
Yeah.
You know, just hang out here, guys.
Yeah.
Because, you know, throughout the rest of China, again, it's this weird situation where there's essentially open war going on in Canton, cities blockaded, but now there's four other treaty ports and everything's going on as normal there. Shanghai, for example, everybody's trading, having a good time.
Yeah.
So it's a very strange situation.
China's a big place.
China is a huge place.
Yeah.
So conditions continue to languish in the small intensity war or low intensity war waging in Canton. With Harry Parkes continuing to press for a new treaty and restitution for the insult of the quote-unquote arrow incident, and Ye Mingchen fighting back through regular and irregular means. For example, he put a bounty on British heads.
Mm.
You know, somebody poisoned the bread in Hong Kong.
Yeah.
You know, there's, you know, so it's just kind of a guerrilla warfare.
Okay.
Eventually, Elgin made his way back to China, but after seeing the resolve of Ye Mingchen, who had blockaded the river, decided any negotiation done at the head of an army would only further damage British prestige. Finally, though, near the end of 1857, the British and French were prepared to go on the offensive.
Mm.
This is from the expedition by Lawrence Oliphant,
okay.
Elgin's secretary.
Yeah.
In the communication which the British minister addressed to the Imperial Commissioner upon this occasion, he alluded to the exceptional attitude of hostility and dislike which had always been maintained by the authorities and people of Canton in their intercourse with foreigners.
Mm.
So complaining, why don't you guys like us? As compared with other ports, to their determined refusal to fulfill treaty rights, to the constant quarrels which had arisen out of this unsatisfactory state of things, and to the barbarous way in which hostilities on the last occasion had been carried out by the Cantonese.
Mm.
As a proof these complaints were not ill-founded or confined to British subjects alone, His Excellency adverted to the recent capture of the barrier forts, which had been forced upon the Americans, and to the fact that the French were prepared to join us in the determination to procure reparation for past and security against future wrongs.
Mm.
So they're saying, it's not just us. The Americans have had to defend themselves. The French are coming with us. You guys just aren't nice.
Mm.
All the other treaty ports, everyone's nice to us.
Yeah.
So the governor said, there's no difference at Canton, implying Chinese people didn't like the foreigners everywhere.
Yeah.
He said, just because you say you're allowed to live in Canton doesn't make it true.
Yeah.
Our treaty says you can't.
Yeah.
So pound sand.
Yeah. The Chinese version says you can't. Yeah.
And he says, no treaty could force the people of Canton to do what they did not like. We don't want you here.
Yeah.
So you can't come here. So the British, French, obviously, not happy about this.
Yeah.
So they set a deadline, started taking forts around the city. And then Lord Elgin said he reserved himself the right to make on behalf of the British government such additional demands as the altered condition of affairs produced by the Imperial Commissioner's refusal to accede to terms of accommodation may seem in his eyes to justify.
Hmm.
So basically saying, well, now I can just ask for whatever I feel like is appropriate.
Yeah.
Which is what they wanted all along.
All bets are off.
All bets are off.
Yeah.
Which is what they, you know, which was the plan all along.
Yeah.
So they attack. They attack Canton with about 5,000 people.
Okay.
Which again is not a lot, but you know, these are troops armed with modern weapons.
More than 2,000.
Yeah, and they have, you know, they have gunship, they have naval support and stuff. Mm. So there was a heavy bombardment, and then troops began to take the city by storm against light Qing resistance. Despite the size of over 1 million inhabitants, like the prior conflicts in the Opium War, the Qing seemed unable to find troops willing to fight effectively. Mm-hmm. This wouldn't change until the darkest days of the Taiping Rebellion several years later, with Zhong Guofan.
Yeah.
Everyone's favorite general.
I don't know if it's everyone's favorite general.
Well, maybe it's Sushi's favorite.
Okay, it's Sushi's favorite. Yeah, sure.
Oliphant remarks, his secretary, that the massive bombardment in the end seemed quite unnecessary given the lack of resistance. He also starts to worry about how they would possibly administer a massive city of whose government, system, and language they knew very little about. Mm. Because of this, and the risk of getting killed by angry residents in the street of Canton, the troops actually sat on the walls for a week while everyone figured out what to do next. Mm. So they climbed up on the walls.
Yeah.
And they're all surrounding the city on the walls.
Yeah.
And then they just kind of sit there.
They don't go in.
No. And there's a lot of discussion in the book of trying to figure out what to do, because 10 of us speak Chinese. Mm-hmm. There's a million people there.
Yeah.
We probably have to keep the local system of government. Otherwise, you see what happened, like, in, I don't know, in Iraq in 2003, when you totally dissolve a government.
Well, they didn't, but yes.
No, I know. But you know what I mean, though?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
No, they were smart enough to realize they have to keep it there.
Yeah.
So.
Unless you can create a new system in place of it, which is very hard.
Yes.
Yeah.
So they broke up the boredom, though, with a little looting. Which has, this is the best description of looting, I think, okay. The most British description of looting I've ever heard.
Okay.
He described it as certain interesting investigations into the personal property of the inhabitants, which are considered legitimate in the case of a captured city.
Oh my God. You know what that reminds me of?
What?
Like during the COVID times, where the Chinese government describes, you know, local officers breaking in of, you know, people's homes and spray the chemical
disinfectant
everywhere and destroying everything in the home. Like I feel like the writers of the two two, you know, the Chinese Communist Party and the British, whoever recorded this,
have a good way of sanitizing the events.
Yeah, they should exchange notes.
Just certain interesting investigation into personal property.
Yeah.
So eventually, though, they moved in with the aim of seizing Yim Mingchen and putting an interim government in place. Mm. Harry Parks, again, initiator of the Arrow incident, personally chased around the governor, describing him as, quote unquote, his game.
Oh, my God.
So they chased him around the city.
Yeah.
Yim Mingchen was captured and sent off to Calcutta to be imprisoned.
Okay.
Supposedly, this was done to ensure his replacements that Ye could not take revenge for their cooperation. Because basically, they arrested all of the head people, and then after a while, they realized, okay, we
don't have anyone in charge.
No, so they basically let the other people go, and then they shipped off Yim Mingchen. But
he's the one that's difficult.
Yeah, but
that has a spine.
Yeah, but however, Yim Mingchen was instantly fired from his position and struck from public memory when he was captured. Mm. He spent a year languishing in Calcutta before starving to death. I think he basically went on hunger strike.
Oh my God. Okay.
So. On the one hand, I feel bad for Yim Mingchen, right?
Yeah.
But on the other hand, to be a Chinese governor during this time period, or almost any time period, you have to be like psychopathically ruthless by our modern standards.
Yeah, probably.
You have to be willing to execute hundreds of thousands of people if there's a rebellion.
Yeah.
I mean, even Judge D, who's supposed to be the wholesome good guy judge, he had literally no problem beating people half to death if they even look at him wrong.
Yes. Well, again, sourced from this fictional accounts of Judge D. But yeah, I get what you're saying. Yeah.
So you know.
There are no clean hands in the in the sea of dirty rivers. I don't know.
But I'm going to make a picture of Yim Mingchen as the profile picture for this, because now we're at the time. There's pictures of people, right? We have photographs.
Well, actual pictures, not
actual
like
pictures.
Drawings. Okay.
And the drawings of him make him look like Genghis Khan, like this just massive, like bearded, like tyrant.
Yeah, but actual pictures?
He just looks like some uncle, you know, slightly pudgy Chinese uncle.
Okay.
So you do kind of feel bad for him.
Well, I do think photographs at this time, like I'm just, you know, in a way I'm so happy.
Yeah.
We have so many photographs of like, say, your favorite historical
Yuan Shikai.
Yuan Shikai. They're all very good photographs.
So this is
very, yeah.
Yeah.
Sorry. Go well, back, sorry. Well, back this, to Yamiche.
Yeah. So this is from Lawrence Oliphant again, describing the problems after they took the city. The necessity of organizing without delay a system of government was therefore apparent. The question for decision was what the system should be. The naval and military authorities had already confessed their ability to govern the city and their conviction that the Chinese functionaries were alone competent to preserve order. In this opinion, the plenipotentiaries thoroughly concurred. Indeed, every hour that passed was affording incontestable evidence of its accuracy. The Chinese rabble had already taken advantage of the defenseless condition of the city and were daily furnishing us with proof of their skill as plunderers. Organized gangs were prowling about the suburbs and venturing into the city, gaining courage by immunity and numbers by success.
Hmm.
So they ended up placing Governor Yi's subordinates in command of the city, who proceeded to cooperate, at least on the surface, with the British and French. There was quite a lot of back and forth here about prestige because, so obviously if you're a Chinese governor, right, you have to be seen as having a large amount of prestige in the eyes of the people
that you govern.
That you govern. So you can't be seen as subservient to the foreigners.
British, yeah.
Yeah. But also the British need you to do
their deeds.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right?
And so dirty deeds.
And the British didn't go travel halfway around the world to kneel to Governor Ming Chen's replacement.
Yeah.
So there's this very sort of weird...
How do they strike a balance then?
You know, they just kind of, I think they... It's complicated. There's different rules about who sits on what height of chairs that they talk about. And it's all very ridiculous, but I think by modern standards. But it was very important to people then, right? Mm-hmm. The prestige of it.
Mm-hmm.
So, but still, Canton was going to be a pretty brutal insurgency for the rest of this time period, as they would keep troops there for peacekeeping, and there was lots of murders and stuff going on the whole time. So,
I'm sure, yeah.
So eventually, though, they left. So we're not going to get to the Summer Palace today.
Damn.
I know, we're not going to get to the burning of the Summer Palace, but...
I thought that's all I needed to know about this time period.
I know, but let me tide you over with some other looting.
Okay.
So this is a joint, remember, British and French venture, right? And so...
Invasion,
yeah. Right? Peacekeeping mission.
Uh-huh.
So,
what? How timely?
Yeah,
yeah.
So, one of the things he talks about is that how like the British, their looting is much more wholesome, as opposed to the degenerate French who are just in it for money.
So, what are the British looting for?
So this is from his account. This is as the troops are heading back to their ships.
Okay,
our jacks. AKA British soldiers, presented a most grotesque appearance as they returned to their ships, waving Chinese banners, their heads covered with Mandarin caps, and their knapsacks filled with spoils of a miscellaneous description. Though to do them justice, we may fairly conjecture that these were rather ornamental than useful in their character. In this respect, our simple tars presented a marked contrast in their looting propensities to their more prudent comrades among the Allies. The latter possessed a wonderful instinct for securing portable articles of value. And while Honest Jack was flourishing down the street with a broad grin of triumph on his face, a bowl of goldfish under one arm and a cage of canary birds under the other, Honest Jean, the French, with a demure countenance and no external display, was conveying his well-lined pockets to the waterside.
So okay, they have looted decorational goods.
So it's fine, Cherry.
Yeah, they're not practical, useful things.
They're just a little bit of whimsical looting. You know?
Yeah.
We're not like those French who steal money. We're just, you know, taking goldfish and canaries and having a good time.
Yeah, and they all go to the British Museum much later and noted just, as donated
exactly.
Provided by the...
So yeah, no, he's saying, oh, we might have done a little looting, yeah. But it was just for fun.
You know, it really does show perspective, like how language can be used to like, it's not a new thing, you know?
To minimalize the events?
Yeah, to gloss over whatever actually had happened, to justify certain actions. It's not a new thing. Still doing it today.
Yeah, and also though, yeah. You can say, and this is actually going to continue during the Summer Palace where the British are going to go, no.
Yeah.
The French were the real looters. We're just, you know.
Also, it's just interesting how they're putting down their ally.
Yeah.
As well.
Exactly.
They're still like, even though they fought together for the same goal,
mm-hmm.
They're like, well, no, we're superior.
We're better
than culturally. Them. So we're more civilized people.
Exactly. The French are just in this for the money.
Yeah.
We're in it for the fun of it. and for the honor. So Okay, honor restored. Governor Ming Chen in chains, back to Calcutta.
Yeah.
British stooge appointed over the city. So they thought, let's go up north, negotiate a new treaty. So they head up north.
Mm.
And this is in 1858, in the summer of 1858. So there's a brief stop where they go up the Yangtze. They talk to people in Shanghai and that area. And they're like, you shouldn't go up there. They're not going to listen to you.
Mm.
Which is true.
Yeah.
They go up there to the mouth of the Peiho River, which okay. leads up to Tianjin in Beijing. The Qing officials don't let them land. They stall them for several months. They say, oh, if you want a treaty, go back to Canton and talk to whoever's there now, because they're the manager of barbarians.
Mm.
So, you know, we can't help you. Yeah. You know, like, well, we just came from Canton.
Yeah. They're
like, well, you shouldn't have left. You know, you should go back there. They resorted to the point where they basically tried to get the Qing force to shoot at them. Mm-hmm. So they'd have an excuse
to use it like we were attacked.
Yeah.
So,
but the Qing force wouldn't do it.
Yeah.
So eventually they're just like, screw it, we'll just invade.
Yeah.
They were looking for another arrow incident. And they're very plain about this in the account, where they're like, we tried everything, you know, but all they would do is
step wrong.
They would just like wave flags at us.
Yeah.
You know?
What, put a foot wrong?
Wrong foot forward?
A wrong foot forward, yes.
Yeah.
That's the saying. Yeah, but yeah. Okay.
They decided to force their way up the river,
mm-hmm.
head towards Tianjin and Beijing. So there's forts blocking the river, and there was a chain across the river. But now, of course, we've got steamships.
Why don't they, here's a question.
Yeah.
Why don't they go around the coast through the sea?
Would,
on the sea.
But I mean, they went up the sea
mm-hmm.
to outside of Tianjin.
Oh, then they can't go into Beijing anymore.
No,
because
there's the river goes up there.
Okay, gotcha, okay.
So they go, okay, there's two forts.
Mm-hmm.
There's a chain through the river. But now, of course, we've got steamships. They can go fast against the current.
Yeah.
They're made of metal. They just ram their way through the chain. They attack the forts with gunfire and naval troops. The battle was harder fought than expected. Despite the low morale of the defenders, much of the equipment was new, as opposed to the centuries-old cannon encountered in 1840 in the Opium
War. Where did they
get
the new equipment?
Well, you know, they built it, right? I mean, China can build cannons, and, you know, it's not a new technology.
Okay.
For your people, Cherry.
Yeah. Excuse my backwardness and low expectations of my country.
But these were, like, newly forged, right? Okay. So they're still old designs, but they at least worked.
Okay.
Right? So they had newer designs and stuff.
Okay.
The forts were designed better to prevent against naval gunfire.
Mm-hmm.
So they had to actually take the fort by storm, with people. They couldn't just blow it up because it was too well protected.
Mm.
But they get through. They clear and loot the forts.
Okay.
And then they progress upwards towards Tianjin,
mm-hmm.
being the first European vessels to advance up the river under their own colors. So this is the same route that the Amherst and Macartney expedition went up.
Okay.
But they had to fly tribute flags.
Right.
As they went up the river. Now they're just flying national flags.
Mm.
So
the British is standing up.
Yeah.
In China.
That's what they
rising up.
That's what they felt. They're like, we don't have to do the tribute flag.
Yeah.
And also one of the reasons they attacked
mm-hmm.
is eventually the Qing negotiators were like, well, you can come, but you got to go by this other route that like tribute seekers come by.
Yeah.
And they're like, no, we're going to go up the big river. We're we're not going to do it.
Yeah, so, we have status now.
We have status now. So,
yeah.
So this is, again, from Autumn in the Heavenly Kingdom.
Okay.
Beneath the pride, however, Elgin mused darkly on the other kind of uncharted territory into which they were embarking.
Mm.
Whose work are we engaged in? He asked in a letter home. When we burst thus with hideous violence and brutal energy into these darkest and most mysterious recesses of the traditions of the past.
Yes.
But as with his earlier broodings, he did not find the necessary element of romance in his head that would defend China on its own grounds. And he concluded almost nihilistically, at the same time, there's certainly not much to regret in the old civilization which we are thus scattering into the winds.
Yeah.
So he's like, well, we're doing a bad thing, but China's a mess, so...
So it's fine.
It's I guess it's fine.
Yeah, it's ripe for...
Scattering.
Scattering, yeah. Looting.
Yeah.
You know.
Little looting.
Invasion.
Yeah.
You know, little stepping on.
Little flag waving.
Yeah, no problem.
They breach the forts, they go up the river.
Yeah.
Basically no resistance.
Mm-hmm.
And the local residents either didn't really seem to know what was going on or were just interested that they were sailing up there, traded them food. would even pull them free of the river if they got stuck in the mud. And they traded with them because they had looted quite a bit at this point. So they just had piles and piles of Chinese copper currency.
Yeah.
Which...
You know what this is?
What's this?
Wealth redistribution.
Exactly.
For the Chinese people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, there's descriptions of how like they had strings and strings of copper cash.
Mm.
And it's like they can't do anything with it. They don't know how much it's worth.
Yeah.
It's only good for souvenirs. So they would just throw
souvenirs.
Piles of it to people, you know, for them to help tugging them free and stuff, right?
Yeah.
So people are quite happy to help them.
Mm. Of course.
Apparently, though, after this incident,
uh-huh,
Qing troops went through here and punished everybody incredibly severely who had helped them. So not quite a feel-good story.
No.
But they reached Tianjin. They dock there.
Okay.
The emperor's like, yeah, fine, whatever. Just give them whatever they want. Just sign a treaty with them. So they sign a treaty.
Mm-hmm.
The Treaty of Tianjin.
Yeah.
So the 1858 Treaty of Peace, Friendship, and Commerce.
Wow.
Right? Good
totally
name.
Totally accurate to the historical facts.
Appropriate name.
Yeah.
It further increased the rights of foreigners in China, giving the various parties much of what they'd wanted for the past 100 years.
Mm.
And so once everybody heard this was happening, the U.S. wasn't going to get involved with the actual battle in Canton. But they're like, well, if you're going to get a better treaty, we want to come too.
Yeah.
So the U.S. is there. Russia's there.
Yeah.
So now there's four of them.
Okay.
But the main combat forces, French and British.
Okay.
Everybody's got their own version.
Yeah.
But the way that it's all worded, there's most favored nation. So basically everybody kind of gets what everybody else gets.
Yeah. We're making our way to the 8-country alliance.
Oh, yeah. We're up to four.
Yeah. We're up to four. Yeah.
Here's basically what it has.
Mm-hmm.
More trade ports.
Okay.
Which is...
This is in the Tianjin Treaty.
Yes. Okay. The Tianjin Treaty. Essentially up to 15 trade ports. There's a bunch more gets added. There's a couple that are going to get added at a later date.
Okay.
So now all up and down the coast, we have trade ports. Foreigners could travel freely within China if they had a valid passport.
Okay.
Especially missionaries. And the rights of native converts were to be respected.
Mm.
Though it's implied not the Taipings.
Okay.
Because again, this is all the Taiping Rebellion is going on throughout all this, which is the real crisis for China.
Yeah. Much more brutal.
Yeah. And Elgin's going to be involved with that too, but this is a story for another time. But yeah, so, but real Christians, Jerry.
Yeah.
Not the Taipings.
Yeah.
Extraterritoriality was confirmed, but you could lose it under certain instances, like if you resided in the interior of China.
Okay.
Also, if a Chinese citizen committed a crime against the British, then the Chinese convict them.
Okay.
So it's not... It's a little bit both ways. It's basically whatever citizen does something, that country's courts do it.
Mm. Which makes sense.
Which makes sense, given the kind of strange middle ground all this is under.
Yeah.
Interestingly, it also says that if Chinese criminals are on British ships, the British will give them up, which is essentially the whole reason for the Arrow incident, because there was Chinese pirates on a British ship.
Right.
And anyway.
Wait, so, but I mean... You know when I said this makes sense, but I mean, I guess modern standards is that if you, like you go to a country and then you commit a crime there,
yeah,
it's that you violate a law of that country, then they have the power to punish you or put you through a court system.
Well, I think it's two things. One is Chinese law of the period, very strange by British standards, by European standards. And I think they just... There was too many incidents where stuff that would like not result in death if they handed over a British citizen, they would just kill them. And so they didn't want that to happen.
Right.
But also it's just, why not? If you can get extraterritoriality, you know what I mean? It's better for you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Why not?
So it also gives them permission to travel and trade up the Yangtze River.
Okay.
Which is a little difficult now considering it's all controlled by the Taipings, but...
But at least that's okay with the Chinese government.
Yeah. Someday. Though they're not allowed to trade with the Taiping territory.
Okay.
That's one of the things that the Qing government doesn't want.
Right. Well, they don't want to give the Taiping legitimacy.
No. And one of the things that the British are slowly discovering is that the Taipings are crazy. Like, they're basically religious fanatics.
Yeah.
And they're not... particularly Christian in the way that
the British Christians should
view it.
Yeah.
And they're thinking like, okay, if we want to actually trade and exploit China, it needs to have a structure.
Yeah.
it should probably be a weak structure, but it needs to be something we can deal with.
Yeah, and not this Taiping.
And so they're thinking, like, maybe we actually want the Qing dynasty around.
Yeah.
So anyway, the right to station ambassadors in Beijing, though China was also allowed to station ambassadors in the UK and France and places, which obviously they're not going to do.
But yeah, they like, couldn't give a damn about it.
Yeah, but there's a bunch of rules on trade and monopoly and tariffs and things, and they get some money.
Yeah,
you know, they get some. I think like
bonus.
2 million taels of silver.
Yeah, but not a small one. But
no,
yeah.
Most importantly, they're no longer allowed to use the character Yi, which is barbarian.
Yeah.
The British, very upset about this.
Yeah.
They've been annoyed about it the entire time.
Yeah.
Especially when after they took Governor Yi Mingchen, they read his papers. It's full of the barbarians, this, the barbarians, that.
Yeah.
They really do not like it. They're like,
stop calling us the barbarians. Stop it.
So this is Article 1.1 of the 1858 Treaty of Peace, Friendship, and Commerce.
Yeah.
It is agreed that henceforth the character Yi, quotes or parentheses, barbarian, shall not be applied to the government or subjects of Her Britannic Majesty in any Chinese official document issued by the Chinese authorities, either in the capital or in the provinces.
Yeah.
So I talk about cancel culture, Cherry.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
Talk about voices being silenced.
Mm-hmm.
Can't use that word anymore.
Talk about political correctness.
I know. Gone mad.
Yeah. So I would argue that the West is the ones who started it.
I know, right?
Yeah.
Like, you can't call us that.
Yeah.
We don't like it. Of all of these, though, the most alarming to the Yongfeng emperor, who was 27 at the time, very young.
Yeah.
And likely more occupied with his favorite concubine, Cixi. Maybe you've heard of her. Than matters
so
of...
So Cixi's very young at this point.
She's like in her early 20s.
Yeah.
The ambassadors. That's the thing that he didn't like.
Yeah.
Now...
He didn't like the emperor was...
He didn't like the idea, or he was completely opposed to the idea that the British could send a ship up the river under their own flag.
Right, this whole thing, yeah.
Station an ambassador in Beijing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that on paper they had to treat this person like an equal.
Yeah, I'm sure he's not the only one.
No.
I'm sure the whole court was unhappy about it.
No, the whole court was quite unhappy, and they thought this is going to be incredibly dangerous to our prestige,
it's
right?
A slippery slope. Slippery What's slope. Next?
Mm-hmm.
We have to stop calling them barbarians.
Right?
I'm sorry. It's actually a very serious
treaty.
Yeah,
it is serious I mean, we joke some about the mandate of heaven and the idea.
Yeah.
But...
And this puts a stain on it.
No, exactly.
Yeah. China is no longer the Middle Kingdom.
No. And an interesting thing is also that Cixi, which apparently was rare for concubines, she can read and write both Chinese and Manchu script, which was... not common among the concubines. She was relatively highly educated before she arrived there. And so she apparently was quite active and would read the correspondence to him and was...
Yeah, she actively took part in the policy...
Yes.
At least the process.
She was the one he trusted to read dispatches and stuff to him.
Yeah.
So she could have been involved with this from the start. Mm-hmm. But so the mandate of heaven is real in this time period. And his dynasty's legitimacy was already being rocked to the core by rebellion, corruption, opium, and natural disasters, Cherry.
Yeah.
The heavens. The Grand Canal has dried up.
Yeah.
Having foreigners puff up the river in their steamships, flying their own flags, and negotiating as equals to the imperial court was unacceptable. However, the foreigners left for now, planning to come back next year with their new ambassadors to ratify the treaty and station them in Beijing. So part of the treaty is... So again, there's no internet, telegraph at this point.
Yeah.
So you've got to agree on a treaty,
and
they've got to go back to the UK, and the United Kingdom Parliament government has to ratify it, and then they bring it back, and then they re-ratify it, right?
It's a slow process.
It's a slow process, in a year. Elgin, for his part, went on to Japan, where the leadership there, having watched the situation in China, welcomed the British with open arms. He returned to China where he had some...
What do you mean open? Was open? Otherwise, they're going to push their way in anyways?
Yeah. So they thought, we've got to deal. We got to be friendly with them.
Right.
Right. We have to engage actively with them.
Not make the mistake the Qing dynasty... Of stonewalling them. Yeah.
Right. So, and they already kind of tried that with the Americans and the Commodore Perry and the gunboats and stuff. But, interestingly, Lawrence Oliphant, he's not involved in the later parts of this story, because while he was in Japan, I think it's a little bit later he was in Japan, he was attacked by rebel samurai at night and his guns were locked in his chest.
Okay.
So he literally had to fight them off with a whip and he got all cut up.
Yeah, samurais would be much better at...
But he fought them off.
Okay.
And he got all cut up.
Okay.
And then he had to go back to England to recover from his wounds.
Okay.
And he like wrote books and stuff. But anyway, an interesting end. Elgin is going to be involved more in this story and with the Taipings, but hold that for now.
Okay. Holding.
So, yeah. So in 1859, so a year later, a new fleet arrives off the coast of Tianjin, intent on making its way up the Peiho River to present copies of the treaty, now ratified, to the emperor and station ambassadors in the city. It's led by Frederick Bruce, the younger brother of the Lord of Elgin, who is to become the UK's ambassador.
It's a family business.
Well, you know, Cherry, there's only so many rich aristocrats. With nothing to do.
Yeah.
So...
No, it's not, you know, it's not gentlemanlike to have a job.
No, exactly. Yeah. So when they arrived, however, when we talked about that in the botany episode, Cherry.
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, yeah. So, but instead their jobs are these high paying, you know, ambassador gigs or,
Hobby, Cherry.
Yeah.
So they arrive.
Yeah.
And not a huge fleet this time, you know, about, I think it's like 30
ships.
Well,
they're not ready for war. They're here
They're here to ratify a treaty.
Diplomatic mission.
But still quite a few ships and, you know, about maybe over 1,000 troops.
Okay.
And the British, the French, and the Russians are all there. So they get there. The officials go, no, you can't come. The emperor doesn't want to see you. They're like, well, you know.
We agreed.
There was the whole thing. We signed a treaty.
You can't just pretend it didn't happen.
Yeah. And then they're like, okay, fine, you can go. But you got to go by the peasant route, right?
Yeah.
And they all know.
Yeah.
We're going to go the regular route again. So they refuse.
Okay.
They get ready to drive through the forts again.
Yeah.
Blow them up again. However, Cherry, this time the emperor has appointed one of his few remaining quality generals to the forts.
Oh.
The Mongol Sengirchen, which I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right. You wouldn't know either.
Yeah.
Any Mongols out there.
I wouldn't know either. Yeah.
Apologies.
Don't call them any Mongols out there. Is that okay?
Mongolians?
Any Mongolians out there? Yeah. Okay. So,
any Mongolians out there?
Yeah.
Sengirchen had previously defeated the Taipings 80 miles outside of Beijing in 1853.
Ooh, cutting close.
And quite possibly saved the dynasty.
Yeah, 80
and
miles.
They never made it that far again,
okay.
The Taipings. So he defeated their big northern push. His job was to prevent the fleet from reaching Beijing and installing its ambassadors there.
Mm-hmm.
And we talked about this before, I think, all the way back in the Opium War episodes. That the Manchus, you know, they have this idea that they're the tough ones.
Yeah.
They're the warrior people ruling over China.
Yeah.
And that, you know, that they have to kind of maintain their warrior instincts.
Yes.
And previously, you know, 50 years ago in the White Lotus Rebellion, you know, they found a guy who was still tough, who could get rid of the White Lotus Rebellion.
Mm.
But like now they're even having to outsource to the Mongols for tough dudes.
Yeah.
Because there's just the Mongol, you know, the Manchus have all essentially gone soft.
There'll be a lack of talent.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, but they find a guy and he's a tough guy.
Although how old is he?
I don't know. I think he's like middle. He's not super old.
Okay.
This is from Autumn in the Heavenly Kingdom. Zhang Feng's advisors disagreed bitterly about how to handle the scheduled return of the foreign fleet.
Hmm.
Some advised accepting it, if not welcoming it. One advisor, a Chinese official named Guo Songtao, argued that it would be in the dynasty's best interest to grant the foreign powers the trade relationships they sought, and instead focus on fighting the rebels. Rebellion was internal, he said, a danger of the stomach and heart. But foreigners were external and wanted only trade. So the solution to the problem lay with solving trade issues, not resorting to the military.
Mm.
To Sengirchen's face, the moderate Guo Songtao argued for the peaceful approach. We've never had any success to speak of with our coastal defenses, he said.
Yeah.
They are not effective, and we simply must not rely on them.
Yeah.
As a side note, and I think this is the same Guo Songtao, he would later become the first Qing official to be sent abroad, living in both Britain and France as an ambassador.
Okay.
So, you know, his foreigner-loving ways.
Yeah.
You know, he got his wish, I guess.
Yeah. It's in his character to have that career path.
Apparently, he really liked railroads. So
just like Natalie.
He's just like me. Yeah. So Sengirchen, however, thought he could defeat the barbarian menace.
Hmm.
While having no experience with foreigners himself, He gathered all the information he could in order to effectively resist their attack.
Okay.
He began to prepare the forts for the upcoming diplomatic mission. When the foreign fleet reached the Taku forts, yeah. they seemed once again to be in poor repair. Mm. They faced no resistance, dismantling the outer defenses, and once again built up steam to ram their way through the chain blocking the river.
But the this is a trap?
Well, the admiral's flagship, the Plover, hit the boom at full speed and was stopped in his tracks. They built a much stronger chain in the river. Mm. They looked at how big the steamships were. Mm-hmm. And I think before the chain was like made of bamboo.
Yeah.
And this time they made it out of like entire tree trunks.
Okay.
So very strong. So the steamship got stopped. And on a coordinated signal, Qing soldiers tore camouflage netting off the forts. Camouflage gun positions began to open fire. Mm. The Plover was destroyed, as were two others, with more ships damaged and running aground in the confusion. Mm. Eventually, the fire slackened as it turned darker, and the British landed troops, hoping to storm the forts by land, as they had before. Mm. However, they quickly wandered into multiple lines of trenches, iron spikes, and water-filled ditches. And as the British troops attempted to cross the obstacles, the Qing defenders opened up once more. As night fell, they lit the battlefield with fireworks, sniping at surviving troops who were huddled in the mud. So this is some Three Kingdoms stuff right there with the iron spikes and the and the traps. So feeling like the white race was in peril, literally, this is what the guy wrote. He said, blood is thicker than water. The Americans broke neutrality and began to fight as well.
Yeah.
However, by the next morning, the force slinked away, having suffered over 400 dead and wounded. Mm. For once, this was a clear victory over the barbarians. Mm. And Sengirechen wrote to the emperor saying that with one or two more victories like this, China would have decades of peace from the foreigners. Mm. The Qing forces repaired the forts and waited and watched the coast, ready to crush whatever foreign fleet returned the next year.
Mm. Now, he was competent in...
Yes.
In defending the
foreigners, the British and Americans, they were overconfident, right?
Yeah.
Interestingly, apparently he wrote the emperor, you know, he's like, yeah, we crushed them. And the emperor's like, okay, but you know, keep an eye out. And I think it's just because everyone says they crushed the barbarians.
Oh, okay.
Right?
So the emperor is like suspicious.
Yeah, there's never any event with the barbarians where they don't say...
Are not crushed?
Yeah. where the barbarians are not reported
whether they were... crushed or not, and most of the time they were not.
They were really crushed a lot in 1840 around Canton Cherry.
So the emperor didn't take this into full confidence.
He's like, that's good. Okay.
Yeah.
But you know what? They left.
Yeah, okay. But I mean, isn't this going to have more replications?
Well, yes.
Because it was supposed to be a
peaceful diplomatic mission.
They were supposed to, like, they came on the agreement
that they signed
from a year ago, and
so
now to them it would be like China's declaring war again.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So from the British perspective, the defeat was cataclysmic. Mm. They had suffered colonial defeats before, but isolated incidents in remote places at the hands of those they considered warrior peoples. To lose a battle, for example, they famously had a retreat from Afghanistan. They lost a bunch of people. The Indian mutiny, Indian rebellion.
The Chinese are not the warrior peoples?
Well,
comparatively speaking.
I mean, I think they've grown...
the Confucian scholars?
Familiarity breeds contempt, Cherry. I think that they've won a lot of easy victories over the past 30, 40 years. I think previously, they were a little bit more hesitant, right? For example, I don't remember, but Napier was one of the early people before the first Opium War.
Yeah.
He tried to force his way, you know, to get what he wanted, and they stonewalled him, and he basically got imprisoned, and he died of malaria.
Yeah.
So, but now they think, oh, we can walk all over these people. So they're very upset. To lose a battle using modern warships against the people they considered martially inferior was enraging to the British. Mm. Not to mention it was done to a diplomatic mission bringing ambassadors under terms of a treaty the Qing had signed, though under duress.
Yeah.
As you can imagine, troops began to mobilize across both the French and British empires once the defeat became public. Soon there would be over 20,000 troops headed back to the mouth of the Peiho to present the treaty to the emperor and gain new concessions by force.
Yeah.
Next time,
so escalations, Jerry, is really this whole
yeah
episode. How did it get escalated further?
Yeah, and really, You know, it's on the one hand, obviously, you know, the British and French and stuff are imperialist. But on the other hand, a lot of what they want, like the stuff that everybody thinks that they're doing, they're selling opium and getting money from the Chinese and all this stuff. That's not really their goal here. Mm. And that's also not the stuff that the Qing court cared about.
Mm.
The Qing court will give them money all day.
Yeah.
That doesn't bother them.
Which they have.
Yes.
Yeah.
But the thing that the Qing court won't do and what the British want is they want to have normal diplomatic relations.
Well, that's the thing though. To them, it's normal.
I know.
But that's not in the worldview of the Middle Kingdom.
I know. Exactly.
Right? And in a way, it's like, I mean, is it the Middle Kingdom's right? I mean, it doesn't matter because it's going to happen by force.
Yeah.
Right? As it did play out that way.
This diplomacy, which by Chinese imperial standard is considered very crude and vulgar.
Yeah.
And insulting.
Yes.
And
although, I mean, I will have to say the devil's advocate,
yeah,
that like it is an arrogant view that every other country in the whole world is beneath us.
I know.
It's what we've been used, you know, we're used to.
Yeah.
But it's no longer the way.
No. Yeah. And the Japanese were smart enough at least to think, well, we are better than these people, but we don't have to tell them that.
Yes.
Yeah, sure, great. Come in, you know, like, yeah, let's be friends.
We can play them. We can, you know.
And then it's like,
yeah, we can put on a show.
Get a lot of those people.
Yeah, I know.
So, yes, it is this very strange situation. But no, the defeat at the Taku forts was incredibly shocking.
Mm.
Because again, you know, people get overwhelmed. There's all these little expeditions, right?
Yeah.
But like the idea that you're there with all of your stuff and they just straight up beat you.
Yeah. The Great Britain is not used to that.
No, it's not happy with that.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Yeah. And so that's really going to happen.
So they're going to come back stronger.
They're going to come back.
I'm guessing next episode is going to be.
Yes, right. They're going to, they and the French are going to come back with the big army. And that is the situation that causes eventually the burning of the Summer Palace.
Yeah.
And all that. And there's going to be more stuff that, again, arguably, the British shouldn't be there to begin with.
Mm.
But there's going to be more stuff that the Qing does,
mm-hmm,
that is going to be, in modern terms, we would consider them like, you know, war crimes.
Mm.
Against British diplomats, against things like that.
But they're not diplomats.
Well, they are diplomats, right? I mean, They're going there to get a treaty.
But again, China at this time, okay, that's not fair to say, I guess.
I guess they don't China have a concept of a diplomat. You only have a supplicant.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's not an equal status.
No.
You know, China's not sending diplomats abroad. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think they are at this point.
I mean, when you address when you address the emperor, you say you're slave.
Yeah, exactly.
And if so, believes this.
If you do send someone to Korea or even Japan at this point, yeah, you're there to give them the emperor's holy words, right?
Yeah.
And then you go back. It's not.
There's no give and take.
Yeah, exactly.
You don't negotiate with the emperor.
No. Yeah, you're just, yeah. So you bring his words and everyone kneel down to you because you represent the emperor.
Yeah.
So it's a new thing for the Qin Empire.
Yeah.
For China, and they're going to take quite a shock to it, which they have, yeah, I guess. But there will be more.
And that's the thing that I think, yeah, is how these events are typically described.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of want to talk about this now because in the next episode, it's going to be a lot about the aftermath of all of this. But
okay,
how the first Opium War and this Arrow War are typically described is like, yeah, the British went in, you know, they wanted to sell opium. They wanted to get a bunch of money out of the Chinese. And so, you know, they did all this stuff.
Yeah.
But yeah, it really though, those two things, like the opium and the money,
mm-hmm,
like the Qing Empire really didn't have a problem agreeing to.
Yeah.
It was quite happy to give them more port. I mean, it wasn't happy to, but it wasn't, those weren't the sticking points. It would give them more ports. It would give them more stuff. As long as it wasn't in Beijing, they really didn't care.
Yeah.
Right? They'll be like, sure, yeah, you can trade in Ningbo, whatever.
Yeah.
But yeah, the loss of imperial prestige was more important than opium,
yeah,
more important than money, more important than territory. And you know what? You know, maybe they're right in terms of,
you give an inch, you lose.
Yeah. I mean, of how the power structure,
yeah,
of Imperial China works, you can't.
Oh, you can't give anything.
You can't lose face, for lack of a better term.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it all goes downhill from that because the illusion, the veil is going to be lifted.
Yeah.
Right?
So when you learn about the Opium War and the Arrow War, did you learn about the Battle of Taku Forts? Were they?
I don't think so, or at least it wasn't impressionable enough to me that I remember.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was very much, I mean, again, this is not a history like college course, by the way. Yeah, okay. Yeah. Like, I'm sure people do learn about this for real, but I mean, just in the dumbed down, watered down version of an elementary school kid or I guess middle school kid. We didn't have history in elementary school. Textbook, it's usually just, you know, the party lines, which is selling off the opium, taking advantage of China, you know, invading on China's 主权, how do you say that?
Sovereignty?
Sovereignty, yes. Which they kind of were.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you know, it's not wrong but, that they weren't, yeah.
But things are starting to get a little weird at this point because already, for example, like in Shanghai, the British, like, you know, the Qing government left, for example, because the Taipings were right out the gate. And so the British government just started doing all the jobs that the Chinese government did. So there's British people running like the Chinese customs house and doing all this stuff and keeping notes in Chinese and and doing all this stuff because they think like, oh, well, you know, like
there's a vacuum.
Yeah. And they give the money to the Qing government.
Yeah.
They take the tariffs and the Qing government is like, oh, wow, we're making more money.
Yeah.
with them running it. Then why not? If we ran it, right? And also all these things were.
But that's different than a British diplomatic mission marching into Beijing. That's different.
I know.
If they're employed by China.
I know. Then it's just like they're becoming part of the system.
Yeah. 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 That's so different than we got to treat them like guests.
Yeah. So it's all very weird, intermeshed. I mean, parts of the British are fighting in some parts of China. They're helping in other parts of China. Yeah. They're running things for the the Qing government in other parts of China, right? Collecting taxes from Chinese citizens in the name of the emperor.
Yeah.
Right? So it's a very
dynamic
and fluid situation.
Yeah. Well, I think the other thing that I want to talk about is that when at the beginning of the episode, you said China had a lot more, you know, agency.
Yeah.
I think it's more so like the local governments, for example, Ye Mingchen had a lot more agency than what some might believe nowadays. And they really did exercise that. And the British had to push their way in through the local control.
Yeah. No, and he could have, I mean, and like, sure, Ye Mingchen could have just gone, okay, fine, you can live in Canton, right?
Yeah.
But like, he's not gonna, right?
Yeah.
And I feel like that kind of gets lost in the sense that like, oh, these officials are just pushovers.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, no, not really.
Yeah.
You know, they often weren't.
Yeah.
And it's actually kind of the exception. And I guess it kind of shows that every time the British do want to do something like this, they have to send in a massive army.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because if these people were that craven and just rolled over, they wouldn't be able to do it.
Yes.
Or they wouldn't need to do it.
Yeah.
Well, anyway,
stop rubbing the
I'm sorry, I'm rubbing the I'm rubbing the chair. Yes. Well, anyway, hopefully you enjoyed.
Yeah.
The finale is coming up and
the burning of the Summer Palace.
Burning of the Summer Palace, the essentially arguably, you know, the end of the end of the Qing dynasty. And the start of the
Or maybe the beginning
sushi.
Of the beginning of the end of the Qing dynasty.
Well, and the start of the sushi dynasty.
Right. Yeah.
Right? I mean, because after this, it's an all sushi show.
Mm-hmm. she's a one-woman show.
She's a one-woman show.
Yeah.
And I almost...
She was quite good at...
Number
the
one
things
schemer.
She was good at.
She was good at scheming.
Well, yeah. She was good at...
Consolidating power. And,
yeah. And she was obsessed with power. She was quite good at gathering them and holding on to them.
If only she had been a little less reactionary. Yeah. A little more open-minded, Cherry.
Well, later when she did become more open-minded. But it was kind of too late.
Yeah. Do you know who convinced her to become more open-minded?
Who convinced her? Yuan Shikai?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. We don't pay enough tribute to Yuan Shikai on this show.
He was
on this podcast.
He was her favorite, Yuan Shikai.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh.
So much so that when she died, he went into hiding because...
Oh, he has no more...
He thought the rest of the court was going to kill him.
Yeah, right.
Because he was so much like...
A favorite?
Sushi's favorite little child. So, Anyway, okay. So we'll look forward to that.
Yeah.
Maybe we'll do a whole episode on how Tsuchi did her coup to take control of the government.
Yeah.
That could be...
Is it a coup, though? Is it really a coup, or is it just a natural shifting of power?
No, it's kind of a coup.
Okay.
Well, anyway, thank you for listening, and have a nice day.
See you next time.